Occupy, occupy. Heart made of ceramic. And there's a bag man here. Well, some people want to remain anonymous, that is. And a lot of people that have come early today or stayed late, they returned this morning. Some were here all night, I'm sure. Let me see if I can find anyone else. Good morning.
Hi, how are you?
How are you doing?
I'm doing well.
Would you like to contribute anything to the statements I've been collecting here about what's happened and what is happening and what you saw?
Yeah, I think that Peace Camp itself was something that was inspirational to the Occupy movement. And everyone that's been charged in Peace Camp, I would consider my personal heroes. And I thank them from the bottom of my heart. You know, there's been some people that have helped me personally grow. And I think also our community personally grow. And we just need the community to help us and get behind those people. So support the Santa Cruz 11.
It's excellent. Yeah, I understand a lot of people were there when Ed got his bracelet, which is going to monitor him, and that takes a lot for an attorney to have to go through all the effort, you know, that he and all the success that's going to happen, because this is putting us on the map as far as what has happened to our politics scene, and perhaps the politics will change in election time.
Right, and we had some great people here at the Occupy, such as Ed Fry and Linda LeMaster and Christopher Doyen or Commander X. And like I said, I really think that they've contributed so much to the movement. And we really owe it to them and to people that just want to have the right to sleep to do a little bit more, I think. And I thank you as well for your show, because you're doing a lot just informing people that maybe can't get out or haven't been inspired to come out yet.
Why, thank you. It's good. And same to you. I hope your show goes back on.
Yeah, eventually, hopefully. We'll see. The American Dream may come back or be built at some point. You never know.
Excellent. So, yeah, I'm getting a few other comments. Thanks.
You're
thanks
welcome.
Very much.
Are you welcome?
Say your name.
Tanika DeFoy.
Okay, and be sure when she comes back on the air, we'll let you know.
Bye.
All right, all you guys. Hey, Danica, were you here this morning?
I got here.
You here with a couple other people that were there? A little bit interesting, a bit happening. So, as soon as I can, I'll get their comments. Maybe I can get... All right, I'm walking over. Good morning. Good morning. How are you doing?
How are you?
Pretty good. I'm here. Anything you'd like to contribute to what you've seen today or yesterday? All right. I've been getting lots of comments.
To definitely today is just it's the Ed Fry day, turning himself in finally after almost 2 years, maybe a little more.
Right.
Yeah, since he's been arrested and then refusing to accept different deals and just going all the way through sentencing until today, where he did submit finally to the sheriff's department. And where he's going to, I guess, ostensibly pay for his crime of sleeping that one moment. I think this is a step on the way to having these laws repealed finally one day, repealing the sleeping ban and having a safe place for people to sleep. Ed is really putting his own freedom on the line and his whole home and family life and his professional career, even his reputation on the line. To have those laws repealed one day, and he knows that he's got to do everything he can. So he has definitely.
Ed's made a big sacrifice, and it's a shame on the society when an attorney who is there having to be humiliated like this. And I think that it reflects on the politics in general in this town. Maybe the DA will have to be very careful at election time.
Yeah, the DA ran unopposed last time, and I don't. My lawyer said they worked really hard to try to find somebody in the county to put up against them, and no one wanted it. Nobody wants to run against. Nobody wants to be the DA. Nobody wants to run against the DA either. So, yeah. So,
well.
So taking him to task will mean we got to find somebody. Someone out there who'd be willing to do it. And I know people in the past. I know Ed Fry years ago ran it for the DA's office.
Yeah, but he didn't have an ankle bracelet then. He could run now with an ankle bracelet.
Huh. Yeah. If you're a candidate, supposedly you can't get arrested. All these are interesting comments. And thanks for all your work, too.
Sure, thank you.
Brent. This is certainly Ed Fry Day, although I don't see Ed, but I did see his half-side, Diana. Ed is out there with his bracelet, roaming around, I guess. Yeah. So we'll be having our Huff meeting in a few minutes. I imagine this will get discussed again. And we'll keep you informed. Free Radio 101.3, which is now going to be transmitting at full volume in a few more days. Maybe as you hear this, you'll be hearing this on the radio 101.3 FM on your car stereo or at your house, Santa Cruz. So keep tuned in. So score we one more. No, you didn't. We have another person here. Brent?
Speeding back, what are your thoughts on turning himself in after all this time? You were at peace camp yourself. And so I'm wondering if you think this is a beneficial step along the way for the movement of repealing the sleeping ban and the state's law. Here he's in Santa Cruz, but he's fighting. He's being sentenced under a state law. Do you think this so is a step along the way for that state ordinance?
I do. I feel it's creating a big target. We're really on the map now in Santa Cruz. There I interview myself as I'm being interviewed. And Santa Cruz has been like a pioneer in this whole Occupy movement. I was in Oregon recently and met an attorney there, and when she saw the button, which is probably a collector's item that said Santa Cruz 11, she was quite taken by that. So I know that other people and other places that have any kind of social leaning that is concerned about the way that just normal things that aren't being normally treated anymore are just being completely blown out of proportion. And when our own defenders of our freedom and liberty are jailed for inconsequential things such as sleeping, what kind of threat is that? It's limited. There are people who have been studying what the state law is to have more understanding of possibly what can come from this. But with enough backing and enough other attorneys, I think, you know, the numbers will make a difference. How many people really are truly showing their support for this, and it's going to change things, if not this year. It's setting up a process where it's going to be happening, and maybe the people will be the ones that will be in charge finally at last. All right, this is maybe the end of my interview now, unless someone walks up.
And apparently that was the end of Coral Reef or Coral Brun's show. Thank you, Coral, for, you know, passing on the word for us poor, malign Santa Cruz 11 defendants, which I'm one. But more important, the issue of repression in Santa Cruz, which we're just an example of. I mean, there's a lot of that happening. Homeless campers who have far more to worry about than most of the 11, at least in terms of their day-to-day reality. But, of course, we in the Santa Cruz 11 do face up to 7 years in jail, prison, actually. Or I guess they'll throw people back into the county jails these days. And we're assured we won't get jail. All we have to do is agree to go on probation and pay $30,000 restitution and take a felony on our record for the crime of essentially peaceful protest at best, and for more of us, for many of us, maybe even the majority of us, simply reporting on or observing and supporting an occupation of a building that has been was vacant 3.5 years, owned by a bankster criminal, Wells Fargo, serving no one, and it was peacefully vacated by those who were there, who actually planned and did the occupation. Which the 11, I do not think, were the primary, or not even the central or even peripheral parties. They got they were many of the people who just sort of, like others, came in and saw what was going on and wanted to know what was happening and so forth. But that's not specifically to even focus on that case. You're coming up next with Bathrobes, Piers, Broadsides. That's my twice-weekly show. I'm Robert Norse, and I'm going to be doing a lot of interviews from the streets today and possibly some interviews on the phone if anyone decides to give us a ding-a-ling. So think about doing that, and we will, I'll be here, and hopefully you'll be there. So let's roll into it and see where we're at. Begin with a little musical number. Get it together here. Call in numbers here are 427-3772, 469-3119, and those are the numbers, 427-3772, 469-3119. And here we go.
Open the door. Did he pull out the chair? Did he let you decide where you wanted to eat? Did he pick up the check? Did he kiss you goodnight? Did he just shake your hand? Mr. Nice always says what's the best thing for you, and he'll never intrude where he isn't invited. He says it's a sign of respect. Everything's wonderful, isn't it wonderful? Wonder of wonders, that's him to a T. Mr. Nice lets you so. Mr. Nice lets you know. Mr. Nice is as nice as can be. Wasn't that Mr. Nice buying you clothes? Did he pick out that dress? Did he patiently wait while you tried it all on? Did he help you decide between pumps or the highest of heels? Did he draw you a bath while averting his eyes? Did he serve you some tea? Did he heat up the towels? Mr. Nice always tells the most humorous jokes. He knows all the best people and deals. Everything's wonderful, isn't it wonderful? He's so damn wonderful, it's hard to breathe. Mr. Nice is still there. Mr. Nice in your hair. Mr. Nice is as nice as can be. Maybe tonight will be different, he'll keep you out later, he'll say something crude, he could make an advance, he could step out of line, even loosen his tie, it's the least he can do. Maybe he'll let down his guard, he'll discover the truth about all of the women he's left in his wake, that his name was a joke, he was given in jail, that would be something new. Who said I saw by your side, wasn't that Mr. Nice, did you give him the boot, did he drive you insane, was he really that nice, was it just a display, did he drink to your health? Did he always defer, did he take a sweet time, they all say Mr. Nice always waits for his turn, was he none of those things, could you give him my number, I'm willing to see for myself. Everything's wonderful, isn't it wonderful? He's Mr. Wonderful, don't you agree? Mr. Nice is so nice as we're saying it twice. Mr. Nice is as nice as can be.
You know, that beer is a second hearing. Let's listen to that again.
Who said you've got on your arm? Isn't that Mr. Nice? Did he open the door? Did he pull out the chair? Did he let you decide where you wanted to eat? Did he pick up the check? Did he kiss you goodnight? Did he just shake your hand? Mr. Nice always says what's the best thing for you, and he'll never intrude where he isn't invited. He says it's a sign of respect. Everything's wonderful, isn't it wonderful? Wonder of wonders, that's him to a T. Mr. Nice lets you so. Mr. Nice lets you know. Mr. Nice is as nice as can be. Wasn't that Mr. Nice buying you clothes? Did he pick out that dress? Did he patiently wait while you tried it all on? Did he help you decide between pumps or the highest of heels? Did he draw you a bath while averting his eyes? Did he serve you some tea? Did he heat up the towels? Mr. Nice always tells the most humorous jokes. He knows all the best people and deals. Everything's wonderful, isn't it wonderful? He's so damn wonderful, it's hard to breathe. Mr. Nice is still there. Mr. Nice in your hair. Mr. Nice is as nice as can be. Maybe tonight will be different, he'll keep you out later. He'll say something crude, he could make an advance. He could step out of line, he didn't loosen his tie. It's the least he can do. Maybe he'll let down his guard, he'll discover the truth about all of the women he's left in his wake. That his name was a joke, he was given in jail. That would be something new. Who said I saw by your side? Wasn't that Mr. Nice? Did you give him the boot? Did he drive you insane? Was he really that nice? Was it just a display? Did he drink to your health? Did he always defer? Did he take a sweet time? They all say Mr. Nice always waits for his turn. Was he none of those things? Could you give him my number? I'm willing to see for myself. Everything's wonderful, isn't it wonderful? He's Mr. Wonderful, don't you agree? Mr. Nice is so nice as we're saying it twice. Mr. Nice is as nice as can be.
Yeah, that was very nice. I like that. That's Mr. Nice from Uncle Banzai's Apology CD. So I'm going to begin without too much ado or announcements by beginning to roll immediately into some recent interviews, because otherwise they'll never get played. And these are relatively, well, they happened in the last, I think, few days. So let's just roll right into them. Some of them are, of course, my main stock, which has to do with the crackdown on homeless people, the criminalization of folks outside, the theft of their property, the abuse they suffer from authorities and vigilantes and merchants and courts and judges and so forth. And some of it has to do with just what's going on around the community that where the issues need to be more sharply defined. I like to make sure that the real issues, particularly as they relate to poor people, as I see it, and I'm not poor myself. I'm okay. I wouldn't call myself rich either, as many do, but I'm okay. And let's hear some of the voices of those folks. And, of course, your interrogator here, and maybe your voice, too, because you can always call in and give me your thoughts. You're tuned to Free Radio, by the way, in case you didn't know, 101.3 FM. You're also tuned to the stream of Free Radio, which can be found by going to TuneIn. Put the words tune in, one word, tune in on your browser, and you'll find tune in. Just then write in the initials FRSC, Free Radio Santa Cruz. So, there you have it.
Of Pacific Trading Company, and we're listening to two musicians, one on tambourine, and it's not really a drum, it's kind of a makeshift percussion, beating a large green sort of laundry basket, plastic laundry basket. The Pacific Trading Company is a sort of a historic location because it's a, about 9 years ago, the fence, the green metallic foot-high sort of barrier that was put up along this large planter that is in front of Betty's, the Pacific Trading Company, and Rosie McCann's. This was moved actually forward about a foot in order to deny people who had been sitting down here the right to sit on this ledge. And it became a cause celebre for some of us at Huff because we were concerned that public space was being taken away from the community here. And this became actually a point where police cited us, surveilled us, interrogated us, and the Heinrichs, who owned at that time the Pacific Trading Company, were doing a... they themselves were not particularly appropriate here in their own concerns about this issue. They really wanted to drive away the street performers and did so in connection with the redevelopment agency. And so it's nice to see these two performers here who are back leaning against the fence and playing a little music. But here comes a host who will no doubt be, she's got a smile on her face, sunglasses, and she's going to move along the people. So how long have you guys been playing here?
Playing out here?
Yeah.
This is our first day I've ever come out here.
Right. Well, you see, she gave you no explanation as to why she wanted you to move?
No, she told us earlier.
You're only allowed to play. We know the rules. You're only allowed to play for an hour. and then you could be here for an hour.
And then you got to move to another location.
Yeah. You got a pamphlet.
Yeah, right. You got a pamphlet.
Yeah, you actually, you can play it for as long as you like, as long as you don't have a display device. That's what the rule is.
A what?
Well, this is called a display device.
So we have a display device.
Right, so therefore you have to. Yeah. Therefore they say you have to move every hour. Of course, this has never been constitutionally challenged, and I encourage you to be the first. I regard it as an absurd imposition on people. So, for example,
I think it's fine. I think it's actually good, because if people are, if there's like a really good group playing in one spot, then if they relocate, it gets a flow of new musicians able to get in that good spot.
Mm-hmm. It also allows people who maybe aren't as good, or newcomers and stuff, to get a chance to play the better spots and stuff. Because obviously there's corners that are really good, and you know, one musician could hog that for a whole day and probably make a lot of money. But it's nice that Santa Cruz is open to bringing in new people and letting everyone get a chance.
Yeah, and they're really nice about it too. They weren't like get out of here. They were just like, it's your hour, and that was great. Great experience.
And I didn't dispute with these guys, who actually, as I said, they said it was their first day. And, of course, they have no way of knowing that that's not why these rules were created. They weren't created to deal with any problems with performers at all. They were created to deal with the homeless people and political activists who merchants want to get rid of from the front of their shops. And they can't simply tell them not to loiter. That's unconstitutional. So they have to create this bogus time, place, and manner mechanism. That is to say, you're allowed to abridge the First Amendment, to abridge a person's right to assemble in public, provided you provide restrictions based on allowing them to do it, but only in a certain time, place, and manner, although that sounds kind of unconstitutional to me anyway, and like a violation of the spirit of the First Amendment. It's still what the courts, the higher courts, have ruled a decade or two ago in the Roulette case back in Seattle, which then became kind of holy writ for all of us in the Ninth District. So the rule that that I'm talking about is the rule that says every hour a host or a cop can move you along, and you can't come back to that spot for 24 hours, and you have to be at least 100 feet away from that spot. And since the spots where you're allowed to actually perform with a display device, which is a cup or a cap or an open guitar case or a container of any kind, so, quote, it's something that's, quote, capable of holding tangible things, which is kind of vague, but that's the wording of the ordinance 5.43 of the municipal code, you are really limited in the number of places you can be on Pacific Avenue. And it has nothing to do with other musicians wanting the spot, although in some rare cases it might. And there was a system in place before this move-along law, which is not really replicated in any other city, well, maybe in one or two other cities, but in very few other cities in the state. Before it came into being, there was a thing called the Voluntary Street Performers Guidelines. And for those of you who know my show, I've given this explanation numerous times, but it was a voluntary arrangement between street performers and merchants, brokered by a number of street performers way back in 1980 under the leadership of a number of people, including Tom Noddy, the famous bubble performer who still comes back to Santa Cruz and does his bubble show every so often. Did it for the Santa Cruz 11 as a benefit a couple months back. It was a very unique arrangement in Santa Cruz. It didn't involve any laws. It simply involved a sort of an understanding that people had among each other that you would perform for an hour, and then if somebody else needed the spot, they could tell you, at the point at which they tell you, then after another hour, you would move along. And in fact, usually people would probably move along soon after that. But it would give people a breathing space and a time. It would give a merchant who's getting tired of hearing the same song, or didn't like to hear a bad performer, a time. And it would essentially allow for a kind of peaceful association. And this went well for 22 years, from 1980 to 2002, until a sort of anal city council member named Ed Porter decided that that wasn't good enough for him because, as I said, there was an attempted revamp of the downtown ordinances in order to criminalize more of the sidewalk to give the police greater ability to criminalize people that chose to move along or chose to a cite and arrest if they wanted, by expanding what we call the forbidden zones on the sidewalk. And in the Santa Cruz downtown area, it is now illegal to sit down within 14 feet of a building. This is on the sidewalk. 14 feet of a bench, 14 feet of a phone, 14 feet of a trash receptor, directory sign, sculpture, crosswalk. It leaves about 5% of the sidewalk open to sit on. And you'll see people doing it. You'll see people sitting. And so there are still some places to go. But if you have to move along every hour, there's a very limited number of spaces you can be at. And this is something that a person coming to town initially isn't really aware of. So tourists who come to town, buy something, and leave, it gives the impression of a sort of a libertarian, free, happy environment, perhaps. And yet, of course, if people try to stay around, establish any kind of street culture here, as, for example, developed in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, that's crushed very quickly by these ordinances, which become the pretext for all kinds of police harassment. And it's I've talked about this on the air before, and I will be talking about it again. But it's interesting to hear the naive comments and the rationalizations people use for controls on them that they, you know, haven't... they aren't really appropriate controls at all, but they wouldn't know that because they don't know the history of the situation. They aren't around, and they tend. I think there's more of a knee. I'm afraid, maybe I'm wrong, that there's more of a knee-jerk submissiveness these days. That's not always true. Sometimes, and there's always kind of breakouts from younger people, from repressed groups, from oppressed groups. So it's hard really to judge. But I had to give you that extensive rap, and let's hear some more. From the street interview from a few days ago in front of the Pacific Trading Company on Pacific Avenue.
So now we got to move, though. Should we make a sign and then play?
No. We could go home and make a sign. Get our gimmick together.
Yeah.
And what kind of music have you two been playing?
Well, I guess right now we're just doing... we did a little jazz. We did a little folk. We did a little random rock and roll improv. You know, just kind of anything that comes to mind.
Hey, do you guys have a name for your group?
No.
Well, get one. I want something catchy here.
Something catchy?
The gimmick.
The gimmicks?
The gimmicks.
That's a punk band already.
They're not done, though. Didn't say the last name of the band. It's the intricate gimmicks.
Well, these two work out their name, we'll pass on. And again, we've been talking with...
Andrew Gibson.
And
N8ST9.
Thank you both. And rather than engage in a colloquy with them or a dispute, my thoughts are that they've just arrived on the scene. And as I walk up and down the street, I see a few other musicians here and note that their reasonable suppositions as to what might justify the law don't really have much to do with what actually created it, nor how it's used, which is essentially to allow merchants, police, complainants to dictate times, places, and presence of people in what were previously considered to be open public spaces. There weren't a lot of complaints. People were spending a lot of time in monopolizing areas for music. Also, it was mainly adopted as an anti-homeless ordinance. Also, the guys just arrived, and they haven't seen the scene or talked to other people, so who knows? On the other hand, these are some interesting considerations that I don't usually hear, and certainly are to be considered. In theory, they sound very good. In practice, I don't think they're accurate. Right across the street here, in front of Logos Books, we are... I do see two performers, one on harmonica, one with a guitar, strumming and a playing. Hi.
And they too have a cap that is a display device for soliciting of coins, although that's not considered panhandling in Santa Cruz, if it's for a musical performance or an artistic performance or something.
Enjoy yourself. The only thing you need from the sun. A family of trees. Walk to be home. Enjoy yourself. The only thing you need.
if the number of shops downtown that are vacant is increasing or not. There's a vacant 1125 shop next to Shogun Japanese restaurant between Shogun and Cold Stone. But otherwise, mostly the storefronts seem to be occupied with business as usual. And here we have a man in his putty tat with a sign, disabled, homeless, hungry, anything helps. Want to be interviewed for free radio. Dyslexic, sold your soul to Santa. And what has Santa given you for your soul?
Tots.
What's the name of that kid? Did you get the kitty for your soul? Or?
You basically, yeah. I found her in a field in the woods.
How long ago?
In Philadelphia, 2 months ago.
Wow. And did you name this putty?
Yeah, my girlfriend gave her a name. It's Nivy, but it's really long. Eskimo name means little talker.
Huh. And so you're kind of a traveling man.
No, not anymore. We just came from Florida to Philly to here.
Welcome to Santa Cruz.
Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah. I see you got your kitty cage with you, some water. How's the city, Santa Cruz, how's it treating you?
Fabulous, but couldn't wish to be anywhere else.
No hassles with police or anything?
Oh, no, none at all. Police have been great help.
Dogs haven't attacked your kitty?
No, it's the other way around. My cat tries to attack dogs.
Oh, so you've got to keep her in leash there.
Basically. She has no claws, but she'll still go after the biggest dog she can find.
Maybe she just wants to play.
I think she was beat up before.
Really?
Yeah.
So she's harboring a grudge?
Yeah, she's harboring a grudge against dogs. You hear her growl when they get close. She gets loud and they put their tail between their legs.
So are you outside at night?
In a van.
Hassled by police for that at all?
Or? No.
How long have you been in town?
Only since the 10th of August.
So are you kind of out of the way or are you prominently situated?
Nah, we're good. We're someplace they don't care.
Very good. Well, enjoy your stay and keep advising us to how things are happening.
Thank you.
And we've been talking with?
Russ.
Thanks, Russ. And there's another large, empty for-lease building at the corner of Walnut and Center Street here, across from the kitty corner from, I don't know if it's the fire department or what's right next to the fire department. All right, so it's August 29th, 2012, about 12:40. And I'm here talking with
Steve Snar.
Steve, I think you're giving your own individual opinion, but you've also been pretty closely associated with People Power over the years.
Yeah, I work with People Power, and I have a longer history of working with the bike church.
And the issues that we're going to be talking about, we've talked about a little bit in the past, and I think I mentioned on the air last time, you're concerned, and People Power and the bike church and folks who are concerned with the accessibility of bikes to low-income people have been concerned about something that's happened recently in Santa Cruz in the last, I guess it's the last 6 months?
Yeah, sometime in the last 6 or 8 months.
And what was that?
Well, the city changed the program of what they did with the unclaimed bicycles. So mostly we're talking about bicycles that end up with the Santa Cruz Police Department. And if nobody comes looking for them after 90 days, they used to auction them off starting in 1996. They were making them available for free to youth through different nonprofits. And since 2008, the bike church was helping to administer it. The police didn't always like doing it, and they were kind of slacking, and we offered, when they kind of lapsed the program in 2008, we arranged to help. So they would bring all the bikes, the huge pile, to our site, and we would invite all these other nonprofits that work with youth, and we would help them figure out what the bikes needed and get the ones that were closest to working order out to these groups. And
how many bikes would you estimate come in per month?
Well, I just did some numbers, and over the course of from May 2008 until present, it was 415 bikes that we actually gave out to other groups. So that was 100 a year. There was, you know, maybe four distributions roughly every year, and then if we gave 100 to the other groups, there might have been 150 each year that came, and then some of them were junk, Or
10 or 15 bikes a month.
And in addition, the bike church has a history of giving bikes away to kids, and through work trade options, if people don't have cash, they can earn a bike. And even aside from the city, the bike church has given away about 500 bikes over that period from 2008 to present. But we were helping to get these ones out to kids and teenagers through these other organizations, and then.
Before we go on to that, a brief aside. There have been yellow bike programs in places like Portland, which is sort of free bikes left around for people to use. Has that ever been tried here in Santa Cruz?
Well, I moved to Santa Cruz in late 2001, and I heard that a few years prior to that, there was an attempt at doing it, but I think it takes a lot of someone's got to maintain them, and they start disappearing, and it never seemed to last. This was only what I've heard.
Santa Cruz or another city?
In Santa Cruz is what I've heard.
Is it happening in any other cities now? You know,
I don't know about the yellow bike program. I've read of programs that were a little bit more formal in Europe, in Paris, for example, where they have. It seems a little bit more like the cart you can get at the airport, where you get it at one part and you drop it off at another, and so it's not just like sitting around, but it's like
you have to pay for it, or is it free?
I think those ones are. I can't remember actually. It might be free or else really cheap. But the idea was that something that you could not even own a bike, but easily get across town and then be able to like. Leave it somewhere else and not worry about it and take the metro or something like that.
And have you, the bikes that the bike church has been giving out and the hub has been giving out here, it's called the hub too, right?
The Hub for Sustainable Living is a nonprofit that includes the bike church.
What's the average cost of a cheap bike for a person who wants to buy one there?
The bikes come and we sell them as is, so they're usually not ready to ride, and so they could be anywhere from $15 to $60, and then, you know, they might need some other work, and so people can use our shop and either pay for a membership or, again, as with the bikes, and use parts. Any used parts and use of the space, if people don't have cash, they're welcome to do a work trade in place of paying with money. And with youth, we usually waive that, and the youth are automatic members, and we give them what they need. This is for any one person to get a bike so they can get around, not that they keep coming and getting one after another.
So the was the police department a significant supply source for used bikes for the bike church?
Well, it was. It helped us replenish our parts, a lot of the ones that were left, because we... Our role since 2008 has been to help other groups get the bikes, and we kept the junk that was left over, or mostly. So it definitely helped us to resupply our stock of used parts, which is important part of what makes it affordable for people to come and not have money and be able to maintain their bikes is to have used parts. As far as bikes, sure, it was helpful. It was a significant fraction, but not a huge fraction, because we get a lot of bikes from individuals and the metro, the bus system. They give us bikes without all this bureaucracy, and they just bring them and say, "You guys are good, great, and here's the bikes that no one claims." So we have, and then probably most of our bikes just come from individuals or apartment building owners that find them when people move out and things like that.
And the SCPD then has had a somewhat more bureaucratic process than the metro or private people?
Yeah, well, really, it's the city. My impression from looking at the few public records that are available going back to when they started this in 1996, when they ended what used to be the auction, is that the city council has said, "Oh, yeah, we have these bikes. You know, there are kids in this county or city that need bikes, and we should give these bikes to kids," which is a little weird anyway, because most of them are adult bikes. But in any case, you know, it's a good intention thing. But the city, I mean, the police, their thing is like, you know, they're police. They don't really care about this. Is just like one little piece of property in a pile somewhere that they just don't want to have to worry about. So at different times, it seems like the police have been less enthusiastic about helping to facilitate the distribution and get kind of annoyed when they pile up and things like that. And so,
why would they simply just give them to you if they want to get rid of them? Why? You say that the process is more onerous coming from them, or?
I can't really tell you that. The nature of the whole thing is shrouded in mystery, because they didn't notify, they didn't have any public process. What happened is after we were working together with them for years, and sometimes the woman who was our contact over in the property department, you know, we might have had she might have been slightly tense with us once or twice, but it was, we had a perfectly good program, and we worked for years, and no one ever said, oh, it would be good if these things changed, or let's talk about how we can improve the program and make it easier for us, but just it just had not happened for many months. So the last one was in January.
I mean, in other words, what had not happened?
The distribution. So usually what happened is the police
department held up on the
distribution.
She would
call me. I was, since the last couple years I've been the liaison, they would call me and say, okay, we have a bunch of bikes. Instead of calendaring it ahead of time, why, I don't know, but they would just call and then we would arrange time. And they hadn't called for over 6 months. So
and before they called, how frequently?
Every 2 to 4 months.
Mm-hmm.
So after it had been 6 months, I called partly just to say, let, you know, if there's going to be one soon, let's pick a good date. It's just because it's summer and people are on vacation, and let's try to find a good time. And the woman who I usually was in contact with, who works at the property department, she did not get back to me. But a few weeks later, Rick Martinez, the deputy police chief, emailed me a kind of curious message about how, for cost-saving measures, and at the request of city council members, they've decided to go with another community partner. And, you know, this struck us as
cost-saving measure.
So, well, it did not explain. So, and it strikes us as odd because regardless of what the reason, how you have somebody that's been working with you for years and doing a perfectly good job and helping to get all these bikes out, and they don't even bother sending us a letter to tell us they're changing the program. They didn't have anything in the paper. There was no public process as far as we can tell. So I contacted some city council members, and after they told Rick Martinez to get back to me, he gave me a little bit more information, and he made up a bunch of reasons which were...
Made up? Are you accusing the deputy chief of fabricating?
Yeah.
Well, let me put it this way. What exactly did he tell you were the reasons, according to him?
Well, okay. He gave reasons which theoretically could be, you know, one could argue, in the, but they're the concept that those things could not have been addressed within the program that existed with the bike church helping to administer it is what was absurd to us. So
what things couldn't have
so
been?
So he says that it took too long because we're a volunteer collective and it took us weeks to get an event together. What the reality is, we were required by the city to invite a whole host of other nonprofits, and so I never wanted to set up an event without at least 2 weeks' notice for the other groups, and so this was actually the time delay. And then he
set
said,
up an event. What kind of event are you talking about?
The distribution that I'm talking about. The event where we would pick a day and we'd have to get the thing in the morning and unpack all the bikes, and everyone would come at a certain time. So another thing is the city had offered when we made this arrangement with them that we could leave the scrap metal and put other scrap metal in the dumpster that was going back to their yard. And then he says that was pricey and now this new partner deals with the scrap metal. But the truth is, you can make money selling scrap metal. It's easy for us. We have a list of people we could call that would be happy to come and fill up a truck with scrap metal. So if the police had said to us, we don't really want to take the metal back anymore, we would have said yes without any hesitation. And he had some other, I can't remember, I'd have to look at the letter. But those were the type of things where he would give in something that if someone was not in the know might sound reasonable, but since they never actually sat down to talk with us, you know, how do they know that we couldn't address those very issues? And so he also said that in the second letter, he told me that it was Hillary Bryant who had made the...
Vice Mayor Hillary Bryant?
And that the new partner was the Bike Dojo. And so the Bike Dojo is a relatively new for-profit business. It's a gym. They do some other stuff. Evidently, they did start a youth program, but they're not a nonprofit. They are a for-profit business. In their youth program, they collaborate with a nonprofit. But when I was administering the program, per the discussions I had with people at City Hall, it was required that every participating group had to be a nonprofit, and any new group that wanted to participate had to get, you know, proof documentation to show that they were. Another thing, when I called the Bike Dojo, the owner, his name is Rob, was, you know, not particularly warm to talk to me about it, but he did tell me that when I asked what was happening with the bikes, that they were selling some of them, and that was expressly forbidden by the program. So I did dig up some documents. Thanks, Robert suggested to me. So if anyone...
That's your interviewer here, in case anybody wonders. There are many Roberts.
If anyone is not aware, there's a... something similar to the Freedom of Information Act called the California Public Records Act, and you can go to the city website and make records requests and within a couple weeks. So I was able to find the documentation of the different, some documentation, from not from whatever happened in the last 6 months, is still shrouded in mystery, as I said, but the documentation from the past is very explicit that bikes cannot be sold, and at first no bike should ever be sold for any reason, and then in 2006, because the bike church wanted to be able to get some of the really junk ones, because like if you're required to give a bike in good working order to a kid, you know, no one's going to take one that's completely broken and has a lot of parts that need to be replaced, because then you would need to spend money and labor fixing it up just to give it away. So the city council made it an exception, or an amendment to the program, and it very clearly designated, okay, you have bikes that are ready to go, you have bikes that are in good but not perfect condition that need a moderate amount of work, and those two categories could not be sold. And only the third category, which was, you know, things that otherwise were going to the landfill that were in very poor repair, those could be sold, but only an amount to recoup the cost of that it took to get them in working condition.
By profits and nonprofits, or by just by nonprofits?
Well, at this time, the program was... It did not specify, but in my meetings with the administration of the woman who worked in the purchasing division at City Hall, made it quite clear that it was only for nonprofits. That particular document does not mention that.
Do you have any documentation that backs up what this woman has said, that it's only for nonprofits?
I only have my own notes from the conversation with her in 2010, but I also have, you know, on file... We have a collection from all of the groups of the proof of nonprofit status, and the only reason the bike church would have no reason to collect that if it wasn't required by the city. In fact, the bike church is not the greatest organization at keeping, you know, files in good order. But I don't have any actual...
I expect you'll be getting that documentation any day now with a new Public Records Act request.
Yeah, well, I could... we'll see.
They have it, I think.
Yeah, I'll try to find it, but I did already ask for all city records relevant to the bike distribution program, and those other ones did not specify that, but I could be if I look through the I don't know how long ago our emails could possibly dug up through the bike church email system, but because there have been definitely times when there was communications, but I think there was a couple years ago.
Perhaps a conversation with the woman you mentioned, who's the purchasing agent, ask her what authority she's relying on. She might have some document.
Yeah, I might get in touch with her about that. But so there is another aspect which is a significant part of the story, which I should mention, which is that I was... In addition to asking for any public records outlining the nature of the program, and I asked for any communications between the city council or the police department and the bike dojo, this was because of the strange nature of how they changed the program without any notification to either us or any of the other participants. And apparently all of us have been cut out of the program, and now only the bike dojo, this for-profit business, et cetera. And so I wanted to find out, well, how did this happen, and why is Hillary Bryan intervening? And I got back very little on that front, and in fact they didn't give me any emails at first. And the woman who works in the public records division, Nidia Patino, or I might be mispronouncing her name, but that's, I've only seen it in writing, but she called me and asked, you know, she said something to the effect that, you know, there's quite a large number of emails and it could be really unwieldy, and do you really want all of them? And so I wrote her back and I said, yes, please, I would like all of them. And then in order to have to ask me something they didn't really need to ask me, they gave themselves a 2 weeks, extension. And then at the very last day of the 2 weeks, in the latter hours of the afternoon before the end of business hours, she finally sent me four emails, none of which was from Hillary Bryant, and none of which really shed any light on how or why this program changed. So at this point, I have no public documents available to me which explain how or why this program changed. But in addition, I wrote back to the woman who's in charge of public
media.
Yeah, and I said, you know, thanks for, you know, following through, but I'm a little bit confused.
Or not following through.
Yeah, well, I tried to, I try to approach it as best I can. So, and I said, but I'm confused. It looks, you said there was all this whole host of emails, and I've only got four. And what, you know, what's up with that? And she wrote me back, and I have this in email and included it in my press release to the media. Is that sorry? You know, she said sorry if my message was confusing. A council member thought at first there might be several dozen emails, but it turns out those were unrelated to city business and in a private email account. And so
confidential to you.
Yeah. So at this point, I've done yet another record request, but again, they get so much time, and it'll probably be late next week before I hear back again. But I'm now asking a lot of follow up questions, including, you know, are city council members or other public officials required to do city business using city email accounts? Could I please see any communications between Nydia at the records office and city council members? Is it true that the emails are not actually publicly available, but that someone has to ask for them, and then the city council member who has control over them is the one who hands them over? And if so, what safeguards do we have to know that they're actually handing over the email and not...
Right. I mean, you don't trust your local city council and their loyal staff?
No, Robert, I don't.
Oh, dear. There you are. You see, you've that could be a poisonous and a toxic thing, this kind of mistrust.
So there are two...
Just kidding, folks.
Yeah. Oh, another and very important part of the story, which I have not yet mentioned, is that... the nature of how it changed in a kind of strange and secret way, and the lack of transparency, and the, you know, suspicious, we thought there were dozens of emails and now there aren't any. All this is strange enough, but then it turns out that the Bike Dojo, this new for-profit business that seems like a strange choice for the city to cooperate with, has a business relationship with the husband of Hillary Bryant. So that he has recently started a pedicab business called Cruisin' Pedicabs, and at least as of a few days ago, if you went onto the website of Cruisin' Pedicabs, very prominent on the front page of the website, says in association with the Bike Dojo. And we've seen his pedicabs there. We've seen Rob of the Bike Dojo at meetings about getting pedicab permits, and they seem to be friends and business partners. So there you have it.
A financial conflict here, a conflict of interest?
It certainly appears so, although...
Let me ask you, devil's advocate, what kind of profit can actually be made off of 10 to 15 cheesy bikes per month?
Well, one thing I was going to say is that a conflict of interest, it seems to have more... It's not like Washington, when people are funneling money to banks, we're talking about billions of dollars. It's sure, it's not a huge amount of money that we're talking about, but it's a conflict of interest nevertheless. And as far as the money, so this is, I can't remember if I mentioned this earlier, but I think I did when I called the Bike Dojo, and he revealed to me that they were selling some of these bikes, and that was expressly forbidden. So most of the bikes were not worth a ton. Like, I can imagine most of the bikes maybe, you know, selling in the range of $100 to $200, but sometimes there were a few bikes that were truly, you know, fancy bikes in really great condition, and they could have been, you know, $1,000 or $2,000 bikes. And I don't know, we don't have any information, they're not revealing information, but he admitted to me, at least on the phone, that they were selling them. And we've seen the Bike Dojo out by the Westside Farmers Market on Saturday mornings selling bikes, saying that, you know, buy these bikes and it supports our program. And so
what is their program?
Well, they started, again, it's not exactly it's not a nonprofit, it's a youth program, but it sometimes teams up with nonprofit, specifically the Beach Flats Community Center, which is a nonprofit under the umbrella. It works with the community bridges, but in any case, so, and it is curious also that for many years prior to the existence of the Bike Dojo, there was another organization in town called Project Bike Trip, which is a youth program in association with the Bicycle Trip, which is a bicycle shop, and they started some high school bike repair classes and some middle school bike riding clubs.
Nonprofit or for profit?
Well, the Bicycle Trip is a for-profit business, but they have a nonprofit partner called Project Bike Trip that is a nonprofit. But then So I find it curious that of all the names one could imagine coming up with for a bicycle youth program, that the Bike Dojo came up with Project Bike, which is two of the three words of an already existing youth program in the same town that's quite successful. And so in any case, so his youth program, I don't know exactly what they do, but when I was trying to find out, I did see that on his website they had a video of Hillary Bryant and Don Lane going down there to have a, you know, give their blessings on behalf of the city for this fabulous new program and their partnership with the city. So,
did you talk to Mayor Lane about this directly and get his perspective on whether this was all appropriate? Did you raise these concerns?
I did contact Don Lane. He said, I'll look into it. Clearly, he knew something about it. So he says, I'll look into it. He later said that he passed it on to the city manager, and specifically it was supposed to be passed on to the assistant to the city manager, Tina Shul.
Passing the buck, perhaps?
Yeah, or, well, I don't really understand the complexities of how we elect city council members, but the city manager is actually in charge of a lot of things, so it might be the appropriate procedure, I don't know. But the what they told me, this was all starting in June, and then I got an email, okay, well, this woman who's the assistant city manager is on vacation, and it'll be a couple weeks, but we're not forgetting about it. And so it's now been 2 months, and I've tried a few times to email her, phone call her, and she's left me messages, but she's never got a hold of me, and she's evidently not looking into it. I've told her on my messages that I'm looking at this document. It seems pretty clear that the program now is in violation of the past decisions by city council, and so, you know, she's had plenty of time to get back to me, and I haven't heard anything from her or Don Lane. Similarly, before going to press, I did, you know, write and call Hillary Bryant and let her know, you know, we've got concerns about this, and I tried to be very, you know, polite about it. I said, I think, although it might not have been your intention, others might perceive a conflict of interest, et cetera, et cetera. And I wrote her all this and gave her a chance, and I gave her a week. She never got back to me, still hasn't got back to me. So at that point, which was then the last week, I did put out a press release about it. And
which we read on free radio.
Oh, cool. And it is going to come out. The Sentinel so far has not got back to me. Apparently they're not interested, but both of the weeklies have shown interest, and they don't tend to want to print the same story at the same time, but the weekly is going to run it next Wednesday, and the Good Times is going to have something only on their online edition. And then we are asking folks, I have not yet crafted our little news blast that we're going to ask people to contact city council members. So if you're listening on the radio and you want to, you know, email or write or call city council and express concerns you have about the lack of transparency, and also about the fact that this successful program, which had distributed, you know, over 400 bikes to youth, has been ended. So, or in short, just to ask for the reinstatement of the bicycle distribution program with the Bike Church as a partner, then we would appreciate that.
I don't want to see Martine Bernal drawn and quartered, perhaps, by four bicyclists.
I don't have any comment on that.
No,
I've never even met the man, Robert, so I don't.
Friendly enough fellow and a very highly paid city official, actually the highest paid city official.
And before we go any further, you are listening to Free Radio 101.3 FM. This is an interview that I had yesterday with Steve Snar. I think I have his name properly pronounced. He works with People Power and is an active bike guy. And as you can hear, has been really studiously and with determination trying to get some information on why the police department unilaterally, without public process or prior notification, changed its long-term policy of passing on abandoned bikes to the Bike Church for repair and distribution among nonprofits. And apparently what Steve learned was this happened through the intervention of at least one city council member, Vice Mayor Hillary Bryant, And Bryant has not been responding to his emails or his phone calls. I don't know if he's done either, which of the two he's done, but if you heard, he said something to that effect. And if people want to get in touch with Hilly or Hillary, they can. She can be reached at City Council. Her phone number is there's a 24-hour message line at Council. If you call 420-5026, again, that's 420-5026, you can get through to Councilwoman Hillary Bryant. Her email is hbryant, H-B-R-Y-A-N-T, hbryant, at City of Santa Cruz, one word, City of Santa Cruz, all small letters, .com. Hbryant at cityofsantacruz.com. And, you know, it's interesting. I think it's important to do this as a way of creating pressure and for transparency by the City Council, for candor, and for an explanation of any cozy relationship Bryant apparently has behind the scenes with the police department. She is likely to be our next mayor. So I think it's important that the city know just what she's doing, and that her emails be transparent, as well as that of other council members. Don Lane, the current mayor, does say he has a policy of email transparency, that his emails are available for access by the public, as well as his meetings with any lobbyists he's had or upcoming public meetings he has scheduled, which is a rarity among mayors, and I've commended Lane for it. You've heard me say a lot of critical comments about Mayor Don Lane. I've gone so far as to regularly call him Gon Lame, which is the name that I dubbed him 23, 24 years ago when he was elected and began essentially breaking his promises to support civil rights for the homeless from the get-go way back in 1989. He was elected in 88, and he made one effort to help homeless people and decriminalize the right to sleep, not anywhere and everywhere, but somewhere, and then he just stopped. And he was a great disappointment. But then again, that's not really a great disappointment if you understand that politicians are politicians and have nothing to do with principles, human rights, civil rights. Those are issues that the citizenry has to address and essentially force upon those in power, because those in power are either likely to try to wield power themselves in an arbitrary way or a self-interested way or way in accord with their own agenda, or they're likely to wield it on behalf of even more corrupt interest groups that have provided them with the funding or are pressuring them to do so in one way or another, such as groups like the Santa Cruz Neighbors, Downtown Neighbors, Take Back Santa Cruz, Downtown Association, Chamber of Commerce, those kinds of groups, Santa Cruz Boardwalk, George Au, Barry Swenson, and big developers, that kind of thing. So, again, you know, it's useful to send a lot of emails. Of course, the real power in the city is Martine Bernal, the city manager, as I mentioned before, gets the highest salary, never has to run for office, is appointed in essence for life, never really has to justify himself before the community. I think there's an annual, yearly pseudo-review of the city manager. I've never heard that it actually involves any real significant questions. In fact, I don't even know what it involves. It happens behind closed doors. It should, of course, be a public review, and it is not. And it's still good. If anybody, you know, feels like it, send hbryant at cityofsantacruz.org an email saying, you know, you have some concerns about how you want her emails and that of every other city council member to be transparent and open to anybody who wants to see them, because they're conducting city business. And the business they're doing, they may be giving you the business, so to speak, to use a colloquial phrase from my youth. Meaning they may be screwing you behind your back. Or they may be doing just fine, but they shouldn't have anything to fear about showing their emails. And you might say, well, it's their private stuff. You don't want to reveal the private stuff. And the answer is they are public officials. And when they're talking about public business, just as the Brown Act requires there be open meetings with agendas and the opportunity for public comment and the right to be present even if the city council members don't like you there, so similarly, they have an obligation to provide information about what they're doing, and they have a right to, I mean, you have a right to know, and they have a requirement to do that. Whether it is actually specified in the statute law, I don't know. But I know that the community should demand it. You know, the same way that oppressed people have to demand their rights even if they are being denied them. And frankly, most people in this community are in their own way oppressed people. Working shit jobs, not getting paid what they're worth, on the edge of foreclosures with their property, facing armed police officers who essentially have wide latitude in arresting people for a variety of pseudo-crimes that you can't even predict. And we're talking about the downtown ordinances mostly for poor people, but for middle-class people who choose, or for our upper-class people who choose to be in solidarity with folks outside, you face the same threat. Political protesters who think that Sam Farr is full of shit for his Obamaton-ish type activities, going along with the destruction of civil liberties in this country, the military budget, the foreign invasions, the renomination of the war criminal Barack Obama. They, critics too, may face the kind of repression that can be leveled in an instant and very quickly, that a number of us, 11 of us, in fact, are facing. I was going to say every day, in the sense that there's only, you know, we already have, you know, we've had to go to court multiple times, dozen more times each, all of us, and we'll be having to go back to court in January. But until then, as I've said before on the air, anytime any of us walks off a curb, jaywalks, violates any law of any kind, we are prone to be taken to jail and held until January. With the revocation of our what's called release on our own recognizance. And they could require that we be bailed out, or they could refuse to bail us. And, you know, I don't know if that's likely to happen. I wouldn't have thought it would likely that they would see 300 people coming in and out of a vacant building in a peaceful protest with police standing by and doing nothing in particular. And then 2 months later, go to the houses of 11 of those people, handcuff 3 of them and take them to jail, and threaten to do that to the other 8 who quickly hustled in to make court dates, lest they find themselves in the same situation as Becky Johnson, Desiree Foster, and Alex DeRosi, who were jailed. So it's hard to say, you know, just what's going on in this community, and it gets kind of tiresome to keep repeating the same old, oh, the Russians are coming, the Russians are coming, the wolves are coming, the wolves are coming, when you don't know when they're coming or if they're coming or what they're doing. But you do know that the same mechanism, the same process is set up and is rolling forward. And it's just eaten up Gary Johnson, who last Friday went to jail for until October 31st. That's actually his new outdate. I thought it was mid-November. But apparently, according to the jail authorities, if they're giving me an accurate account, I called them today, it is October 31st, he'll be released. But that's still several months in jail. He's actually out at Roundtree facility, for those who want to contact him. And it is also, once he steps outside jail, he has 2 years suspended sentence hanging over him for the crime of sleeping in front of the county building to defend the rights of every member of this community, particularly homeless people, but everybody else who feels that they should have the right to sit in front of the county building at night with a sign on whatever issue is important to them. This was something Gary was arrested for doing, jailed, and then tried, convicted, and sentenced to 2 years in jail for. That is really a sobering fact. And though the judge apparently didn't want the negative publicity of sending him to jail for 2 years, and Gary declined probation because he said one of the conditions of a probation would be to obey all laws, and one of those laws that Judge Grim Gavel Gallagher, as I like to call him, stated what that had to be obeyed was the law that said you could not sleep outside at night. And since Gary is homeless, he has no choice if he's living in Santa Cruz to sleep outside at night somewhere. I suppose he could stay awake all night. But once you start even considering those things as any kind of reasonable possibilities, you realize how grotesque, bizarre, cruel, and unusual this kind of punishment is. So, a couple things more about Gary, because I did give a call to the jail today. And what did I find? I'll consult my notes here. I'm having a little problem with a computer as usual, or actually a different computer. But Gary is in jail, and if you want to write to him, and I think that would be a good thing to do, because Gary, and I can speak from experience in jail myself, about 17 years ago I was in jail in San Francisco. And I was only there for a month, but I'll tell you, it's not the happiest place to be. It's kind of lonely. It's kind of frightening. It makes one crave contact with people outside. And so if you want to write Gary, you can. His prisoner number is S-228822. Again, S as in Sally, -228822. And his name is Gary Johnson, J-O-H-N-S-O-N, Gary Johnson, the standard spelling. And he is at the Roundtree facility. That's not Roundtree, it's Roundtree, R-O-U-N-T-R-E-E facility, at 90 Roundtree Lane, Watsonville, 95076. Watsonville, 95076. That's, again, Gary Johnson, 222-8822. That's actually S-222-8822. Roundtree Jail, 90 Roundtree Lane, R-O-U-N-T-R-E, Roundtree, Watsonville, 95060. And if you want to put money on Gary's book so he can call out or eat food that is not from the kitchen, and Gary is a vegetarian, so that would help him preserve the diet, which he feels is best for him. I don't know if it's medically demanded or matter of principle or a wild and crazy preference. You can put money on his jail at the Santa Cruz County Jail just by walking in there, and I think it's any time of the day or night. I thought there were regular hours to do it, but I think I was told otherwise, that it's open 24 hours. If it's locked, you just sort of pick up the little phone outside and you say, hey, I want to put money on the... And they kind of buzz you in, and you put money in the machine, which takes at least $2 of your money as a service charge, so that the corporate masters of the private prison industry can get more money for leveraged buyouts of other industries. It's a way of, you know, helping those who are helping themselves already to what the rest of us already are trying to hold on to as it kind of slips through our grasp. If you want to be a visitor, to visit Gary in Watsonville, you've got to send him a letter that requests that he ask him to get a visitor's, an inmate visitor request form is what he needs to get. And he can only have 6 visitors on it. You can be one of them, probably, because I'm not aware that anyone has filed such a form yet. Somebody may have already. I mean, anyone has asked that Gary file such a form yet. And he will fill it out, but you have to include, for Gary's information to put on the form, your birthday, driver's license, and I suppose it would be helpful to put down bank account numbers, sexual preference. No, you don't need to do that. But apparently what is required is the birth date and driver's license. So I can keep tabs on you just in case. You know, you never can tell who you might be. And you can also, there are a couple of phone numbers to call if you want to try to establish a phone account that will allow you to receive collect calls from Gary more easily without that money being subtracted from his books. It sounds like the easiest way is to put money on his books and do it that way. His books meaning his jail account. I've written about this and kind of what I've just told you I've summarized and put on online on Santa Cruz Indie Media, indiebay.org/Santa Cruz, which is the website I regularly post on and that others have been posting on recently. And thank you very much for those of you who did, Leslie, Brent, others, for the pushback on the issue of the crackdown on homeless camps, which actually is, of course, directly related to why Gary went to jail. Gary went to jail because he was trying to establish the right of people outside and citizens generally to use the public spaces around the courthouse to protest the government and petition for a redress of grievances. He wasn't arrested for littering. He wasn't arrested for poo-pooing in the bushes. He wasn't arrested for assaulting people. He wasn't arrested for vandalism. He was arrested for sleeping. Because at night he fell asleep there with a sign that said, sleep is not a crime. Which, of course, seems to me to be an act of criminal behavior by the deputies who arrested him, the jailers who jailed him, the judges who sentenced him. And when he went to court, as I hear he did, he was ordered to turn himself in on Friday. I think I talked about this on the air on Sunday. I don't know for sure if I gave all the details, but he was ordered to go to jail by the judge. I know I mentioned this when he went back to court. The judge first sounded like he was going to give him time to prepare for jail. And Gary then asked, well, will I be allowed to sleep if without being arrested if I, because I can't, you know, I can't follow your orders of obeying all laws even tonight because I'll be outside. And he said, okay, you go to jail at 3 o'clock today. Which I don't think was a helpful move on the judge's part. I think it was his attempt to enforce a kind of vicious, draconian, I mean what I say, if we decide we want to fuck with you, we'll do it. Even though it's quite clear that of the 1,000 to 2,000 homeless people, if even a significant number of them showed up outside the jail, 100 or 200 with their sleeping bags, they would be, and so put us in jail. We're going to join Gary. There would be nothing they could do. There would be no space. It would be outrageous for them to try to do anything. And, of course, authorities act outrageously all the time and abusively and lethally. I know it's true. So it doesn't mean that will be successful. But what I'm saying is that the act of the judge's action was to sort of anticipate and sort of lay down a fearful threat to those, a fear-slaked threat for those who might do what Gary did, which is sleep outside and protest of what the court system is doing to homeless people and what, of course, the police department has been doing in the last 6-7 weeks to homeless people, cracking down, destroying camps, giving citations when there's no shelter and it's acknowledged there's no shelter, stealing and destroying their property. And in the midst of all this, well, we have Gary in jail, and I think he'd appreciate some letters and some support. So I encourage you to think about that. City Council, on the other hand, is now being pressed by people who have who are supporters of Gary. I'm one of them, but there's a letter from Leslie on Indy Bay. It's Leslie Dinkin here. According to the Indy Bay account, she writes a letter that she sent to the Sentinel. She's posting it. And frankly, Leslie is not your most wild and crazy extroverted person. She's a very quiet person in her own way. And for her to do this, I think, requires a considerable amount of courage and outrage at what's going on. I don't think she wants to be a public personality. And the fact that she's making this statement and signing her name to it and actually putting herself at the mercy of the Sentinel wolves, because if you go to the Sentinel, for example, today, the lead story was about the campground crackdown. You can see this mass of toxic bigotry, and it sounds a little bit like sort of anti-Semitism in Germany in the 30s, with homeless people taking the role of the Jews. And it's just, to me, it's just depressing, and it angers me. And I, you know, I wrote something on the website before I realized, you don't want to argue with these folks. They are being led in the wrong direction by their own feelings or by the propaganda, bad experience they had with a homeless person. I'm not sure what, in any particular case, is leading folks to call for people to be deported from this county, for people to be jailed, for people to be harassed and arrested and have their property destroyed, making snide comments about people's lives. It's sad that this is happening, and it's, you know, it's something I get on my high horse about and get self-righteous about as well. I admit it. But anyway, Leslie's letter, as she writes on Indy Bay, I sent this letter to the editor of the Santa Cruz Sentinel expressing my feelings about the front page article today. Even if it's not published there, I want it published here and watch for an event posting as well. Why is the forced relocation of people who camped to survive called a solution? My progressive advocate friends believe the community of Santa Cruz is compassionate, but as a newcomer here, I am disheartened by the paucity of public outrage or sorrow expressed, and buildings in our community that might be used to house folks stand empty, such as the Brookdale Lodge in my own small community. That's her letter, which the Sentinel may or may not publish, and I'll look at that Sentinel story and I'll probably discuss it a little bit, though it's essentially a police department press release with a sort of a little bit of counterpoint from someone from the census-taking organization that sort of points out that people, homeless people are just being moved around. It's not really any kind of a solution in the sense that if you want to consider depriving people of their rights, harassing them at night, stealing their property, a solution to anything other than... I don't know, some sort of sadistic impulse, scapegoating impulse in the hearts of, I think we all have that potential impulse, but hopefully not to act it out in this way. She also writes, just yesterday a new coalition formed to stand with the homeless. There will be a vigil in March next Friday, September 7th, it's a week from tomorrow, starting at 7 p.m. at Santa Cruz City Hall. We plan to advocate to change the law in Santa Cruz that makes it illegal to camp here. I want to go further and advocate for the creation of supportive housing for people in need of the community's help in recovery. If you agree, join us. And on one of the comments, if you look at the comment, there is a great flyer by a man who's already under attack, Brent Adams. Again, candlelight tent vigil protesting homeless camp sweeps. SCPD, City Parks, and Santa Cruz City Council are 7 weeks into an attack on camps in the woods. Personal belongings have been trashed and lives are being destroyed. Where are people to sleep? 300 citations, 100 camps destroyed, 150 arrests. Join the community in expressing our sadness and outrage at this disregard for the law, human rights, and dignity. September 7th at 7 p.m., City Hall. Bring a tent if you have one. And there's some pictures of some tents. Occupy to liberate tents that people are holding above their heads and sort of looks like they're carrying around with the masses of people. And that was a sort of a device used by some activists when authorities started claiming that having a tent on public property was not a First Amendment activity but an act of lodging. It was in essence a crime because you weren't getting the permission of the authorities to criticize them. You got to get their permission before you can criticize them in that way, which of course is ridiculous and chilling. But that was where this sort of the so-called tent monster approach used, where people would just use tents as a form of kind of personal garb. They would walk around with it, and then they would set the tent down, and they would be in the middle of it as a sign, as a placard, as a way of expressing both the words that were on the tent and the notion that one needs a tent to survive outside in cold weather. And the weather is becoming cold again. It can be really hot during the day, and it gets cold at night. And what Brent Adams writes, please join us in community as we express our sadness and outrage at this campaign of harassment of those who are the most vulnerable. We will gather at City Hall 7 p.m. Friday, September 7th. We will hold a circle and share some thoughts before we slowly walk together through town carrying candles and lofting tents above our heads. We'll traverse Pacific Avenue, then visit the River Levee, and then back to City Hall. We expect to have a Dixie Cup hooded candles, but please bring flashlights and tents if you have them. This is the first step in a new multi-tiered campaign to address the city's criminalization of outside night sleep. We welcome you to join us. The City of Santa Cruz has been using the SCPD and the City Parks Department to attack homeless camps. We are in the seventh week of the campaign, and it's, which has seen more than 300 citations given, and this is repeating the stats, more than 100 camps destroyed, and personal belongings trashed, and more than 150 arrests. When the Homeless Services Center, which I call the Homeless Lack of Services Center, has closed the Paul Lee Loft, while it has closed that loft shelter, the city has offered no other solutions to people who are survival camping in the woods, river levee, and downtown. Actually, when it was open, they had no solution either, and it didn't really make much difference. But the significance of the loft closing is that there's a part of the camping ordinance created because of the activist activity, Peace Camp 2010, that Gary Johnson and Ed Frye were convicted of, and that Gary went to jail for, and Ed has an ankle bracelet and house arrest for, that now requires city attorney to dismiss tickets for those who signed up for the waiting list of the Pawley Loft and the River Street Shelter. If they let you on the list, and some people can't get on the list, they won't give you documentation if you're on the list. They won't give you documentation if the shelter is full and you go to court. They'll go to court and testify against you, as they have on at least two occasions in the case of Gary Johnson and others. But there is this law that says if you're on the waiting list of these two private organizations, which is kind of peculiar in and of itself, since why should private organizations have some special entree that will allow them to decide that you can now suddenly no longer be illegal because you're on a private organization? That's a way of allowing private organizations to profiteer off the misery of those who are caught up in the toils of the sleeping ban and the camping ordinances and the blanket ban. Still, you can't even be on those lists. The lists will not. We have no guarantee the lists are going to exist because the Pawley Loft is due to be filled up with overflow suddenly from another shelter that is being remodeled, a long-term program called the Page Smith Community House. And that means there'll be no waiting list for the Pawley Loft. You can't get on the River Street Shelter waiting list unless you have a very specific set of requirements. It's a sort of a half of it is a mental health oriented shelter, and half of it involves vulnerable people like women and elderly people. And it's not that these aren't nice resources for a very few people at a very high cost comparatively compared to, let's say, a low-income campground that could be set up, but that authorities have refused to seriously consider for decades, primarily because it would serve a much broader number of people and would actually expose the real nature of the homeless situation. And it also might provide a nice organizing point for people to organize. It's hard and also there's a lot of bigotry in the community that says, oh, this will mean all the homeless people will come to town to stay in the wonderful campground. Not exactly, actually. It was not the case in Miami when the sleeping ban was lifted there in 1999. It was not the case in Portland, Oregon, or in Austin, Texas, when sleeping bans were lifted there at the beginning of the early 21st century, about 10 years ago. It's not the case in Los Angeles and San Diego when sleeping bans are lifted. There's no influx of massive number of people. It just doesn't happen. It's not that it's such a wonderful thing to sleep outside necessarily for most folks. It is a necessity to sleep somewhere. That's the point. That's why this September 7th vigil that is going to be happening. Hopefully they'll take back the levee and take back the parks. And the problem is people are also apprehensive because once you walk into those areas, that's technically illegal, you see. And it's interesting. Bigoted groups like Take Back Santa Cruz, in collusion with the city's Commissioner for the Prevention of Violence Against Women, will walk along the levee as a sort of a safety measure and a take back the night activity. But to take back the rights of the people who have to be outside at night is not something that the authorities are likely to smile on, if whatever their reaction is. That seems to me to be the case. But their reaction, of course, isn't important. It's the reaction of the community that counts, and I'm glad to see this being raised. It's not the most militant thing people could do. That was done a year ago when people set up a campsite and maintained it for 2.5 months at the Santa Cruz Courthouse. It could be done. It was done. It may happen again. You know, I've been very negative about the whole sad and kind of depressed about the dispersal of Occupy Santa Cruz and Occupy throughout the country. But it's natural that people attacked by the police departments and economic conditions at the same time will try to take defensive measures as best they can. It doesn't mean they've forgotten the issues. doesn't mean they don't care anymore. It means that they're intimidated. And people will be intimidated. Some people will, you know, retreat into their shells for long periods of time. Others may be biding their time. I don't know what people are doing, actually. I know that some people, that there is a solid core of people that continue to work on a lot of issues that they weren't working on a year ago before the Occupy movement began. And that is, that's true, you know. I mean, I sometimes say it to sort of, you know, pat myself on the back and cheer myself up. But I think it's also something that just is a matter of fact. It's real. And it is heartening for those of us who want to see changes. Looking again at the Indy Bay news kind of, I don't know, segment on the right, if you go to the Santa Cruz Indy Media Collective website, you'll see a couple of stories. There's robbery follows exclusion from the homeless lack of services center for a disabled woman, and I talked about that and actually had the woman involved in the studio, Andrea Morgan. She has been, I think she found some shelter for the last four nights in the Red Church or the Red Church program. They don't actually take people into the Red Church. Heavens forfend, Cynthia Matthews might object. She's our former mayor. She's running for city council again. She tried to have Pastor Joel Miller, Father Joel Miller, defrocked for not even for putting people up overnight at his church. He didn't do that. He was actually very conservative force and trying to cut back on the program that Rene Curry had established as groundskeeper some years ago. But he did have a Monday night meal, and he still does every night. And that meal was at huge numbers of people on Monday 3 days ago. It had one worker there estimated 200 people, which is huge. And I just saw this line that went around the room and continued to go around the room, and it never seemed to end. It was the longest line, the largest amount of people I've ever seen. Admittedly, it's the last meal of the month. And admittedly, we're in the situation where the police are cracking down and destroying homeless property, and people may be finding it a little hard to get food as they have to spend to buy their blankets again, find other stuff that's been taken, replace it in some way. So that I didn't really get a clear sense of that. Those are the kinds of questions that I'm realizing now. Maybe I'll ask next week, at the beginning of the month, when some people get their disability checks or veterans checks or general assistance, it may be different. We'll see about that. Andrea has not yet filed a police report, as far as I know. I think she doesn't want anything to do with the police. She has no confidence in them. They apparently, when she had a dispute with her storage locker people, the police had her charged, and that charge has been, it's either dismissed or suspended. I'm not entirely sure. Steve Plaich has more details on that. Maybe I'll give him a call and ask him what the latest is on that. But that's too bad. I wish Andrea did go to the cops, because I think little confidence as I have in police department behavior with respect to homeless people. I mean, with respect to people in houses, they're slow enough. Although, I've got to admit, the police department on a number of occasions has retrieved my stolen bumper sticker car. So, you know, and I've thanked them for it. I've written them letters commending them for doing it. And when I get helped, I do appreciate it. But because I see so much of the energy going into intimidating and terrorizing poor people as a sort of a matter of institutional hate crime, it makes it real hard to say anything positive about any police officer in this city, even though as individuals, I'm sure they're fine people and they love their families and, you know, pet their dogs and probably, you know, jolly dinner companions and, you know, ordinary folks in some ways. But once ordinary folks become part of a juggernaut machine that is destroying lives, they acquire a different kind of identity and you have to regard them in a different way. And that's just sad, but true. So, what else has been happening this week that I want to look at? I think I was going to... it looks like I interrupted the... the audio that I was doing with the interview with Steve Snar. about the bike church. And again, I encourage people to give a call to Hillary Bryant, the vice mayor. Let her know that you're concerned about, you know, is she giving a pass to someone who's a business partner with her husband? Is it happening behind the backs of the community? Why is it happening for a for-profit organization? Is this a political move to essentially punish the bike church, which is in the same general collective area as the Sub Rosa Cafe, which is a known hangout of folks of a very usually or pro-homeless, some of whom are self-described anarchists, and some of whom are socialists, some of whom are activists of all kinds of different stripes. And what's going on here? Why is this being done in a public manner? If you're going to change the policy that's been going on for years, do so openly. Do so with public debate and discussion. Don't have a cabal headed by Coonerty, Bryant, Geraces, and Robinson. These are the four council members doing so behind closed doors in collusion with police department officials like Martinez. 420-5026 is the phone number to call. 420-5026. You call the, you'll get the voicemail and leave Hillary a message saying you'd like to have her get back to you. And you'd like to have her make her voicemails transparent. And every member of the city council, all their emails, not their voicemails, their emails should all be transparent. They should be available to members of the community to look at if they want. You know, if people want to give personal emails to city council members that don't concern personal business, sure, that's private. But stuff that concerns city council business is public, and they need to be put into the public record, just as letters to the city council are public documents. So think about doing that.
You're also a man who's written a letter to the paper with some concern about the, I have to call it, bragging the police department has done about the destruction of homeless survival camps.
Yeah, you know, strange that I'm happy to be working with the Good Times on an article about this issue we were just talking about, but I wrote them a pretty, well, again, polite, but...
You didn't like their police
yeah.
department puff piece about how nice it was that all the police were destroying these camps in the gentlest possible way?
Yeah, I thought it was really pretty bizarre and outrageous, and I might expect trash like that from the Sentinel, but I feel like they outdid even the Sentinel on how bad of reporting can you do on homelessness. So I wrote them a letter. In fact, I wasn't sure if they would print it, but in fact, they put in bold at the top when they printed it, bad journalism, ? Because that was the first line I said something about it being bad journalism. I can't remember exactly what I wrote. People are welcome to look it up. But
more like cop journalism, I think.
Yeah, so it was a horrible article. It started with a story of police officers with guns drawn charging into a campground that they didn't even know if anyone was there, and kind of like constantly justifying the police position and how it could be dangerous, and how quoting police talking about how homeless aren't people who are just you know, out of luck, but these are people who want to be there and are drug dealers and criminals and on. And there was
some like the Republican convention kind of stuff where you have this, I'm told, police outnumbering protesters 10-1, that sort of thing.
Yeah, well, and it was also problematic, even if they want to give you this bizarre theories of the police about homelessness that aren't backed up by any facts, then there was, if it was actually a journalist and not just, you know, somebody advocating for a certain position, then
regurgitating police department propaganda.
Then why not try to track down some actual homeless people and interview them and see how they think or what they feel about it? And there was only a few quotes from people who were critical, and none of them are actual homeless people. And they were kind of towards the end of the article, and the whole slant on the whole was pro police. So yeah, as somebody who has the bike church is not. Like, our fundamental mission is not to be a homeless service provider, but we are. Part of our goal is to be open to anyone, regardless of whether people have money. And so, while the majority of our patrons have the minimal amount to pay, you know, a significant minority are homeless or very low income, or we don't ask for proof of residence. But if someone just says I don't have money, then we take their word. You know, they're welcome to do work exchange. So we do serve a lot of the homeless population, and therefore, you know, on a daily basis, being at the bike church and in the office of the hub, I am working and running into and encountering this population, and I In fact, I have had some pretty terrible experiences with some individuals, you know, physical threats, you know, aggressive behavior. One time, even outside of here, I was leading middle school students on a bike ride. We had part of this club through the nonprofit I mentioned earlier. And we were in Harvey West Park, and this guy was shouting, and he didn't like that we were in a park that he feels like is his park because that's his home. And he was shouting and yelling and acting crazy towards us, and I had to kind of, you know, get in his space and get him to leave. So I thought to write a letter because I feel like as somebody who has encountered some of the worst spillover effects of what happens to disturb people who have no social services, then I'm a good person to understand the issue and to be able to say that the police aren't helping, and that this is something that seems quite obvious to me, that if you have people who are disturbed, you know, maybe they're drug addicts, mentally ill, or just angry, or post-traumatic stress disorder, who knows, but clearly people are disturbed, and just to rouse them from their camp and stick a gun in their face or, like, push them around and then steal their stuff, like, they're still here. They're going to have to sleep somewhere else. Now they're angrier. Now they're more scared. Now they're more antagonistic towards society. So that was kind of the point of my letter, which you can't get into that much in a little letter to the editor. But that's the gist of it, is that I think, of course, it's totally heartless, and we have a society that doesn't have enough jobs for people, and then it's heartless to go think that we have a right to violently rouse them from the makeshift homes that they make, and even kind of aiming towards the more conservative people who don't care about the compassionate part. You know, that my point is that, like, even for the rest of us, you know, it's not actually helpful. Like what is accomplished?
We're not getting rid of the fucking bums. You're just moving them around from place to place.
Exactly. You know, I actually wrote a satirical letter to the editor a few years ago that the Sentinel chose not to print, in which they were doing a less intense version of this pushing homeless around when they start, and then you know, they all started clustering on the levee, and they would push them down from one part of the levee and then they would appear somewhere else. So I wrote a letter at the time about how I appreciated these measures to, you know, try to move the homeless people around, clear them out, but that what we really needed was a final solution to homelessness, and, you know, you can imagine where it went from there.
Sure, solution. I've heard of that. Yeah, they tried that once, and they didn't quite succeed. You know.
But seeing as we're not quite that in that heartless of a country where no one's wanting to actually, or no one's willing to publicly say that they actually want to kill all the homeless people, then, you know, this whole policy of...
Let them kill themselves off. That's the way to go, you know. Not in my backyard, you know.
It just stands... It's just completely incomprehensible to me. Like, what is it supposed to be... What is the goal here? What's being accomplished? I don't know what public...
You think Hillary Bryant, perhaps?
Yeah, I would assume so. And I know the mayor is it's a weak mayorship in Santa Cruz. It doesn't actually have much power.
Not to mention a weak-ass mayor.
Yeah, but I am disappointed that Don Lane, who comes out of...
I like to call him Gone Lame.
Yeah, having worked a lot with homeless services, that I would have wished that he could have taken a stronger stance and more leadership, even if he is not in enough powerful position to stop what's going on, it's kind of like what I see with Democrats in Washington, where they suppose claim to be against something, but they don't take a stand against it, and it's like, well, what's the point of being in office?
Romney's going to be worse. It's very simple.
Yeah, I'm shaking in my boots. How much worse could he be, right?
Well, we've been talking with that naive idealist and man about bikes,
Steve Schnarr.
Anything you want to conclude with, Steve?
Nothing specific comes to mind.
Where can people get more information? I know you've written a letter, the Good Times letter that you wrote can be found online at the Good Times website. Your unpublished letter to the Sentinel can be found probably in the dusty archives of your office somewhere.
I think I lost track of that. But I was looking on Indie Media, Santa Cruz, Indie Bay yesterday, and Brent Adams wrote a pretty good piece. It was a lot longer. Without the space limitation, he actually did some journalism and, like, went and interviewed a bunch of people. And so that, if people want to know about the homeless issue, which is being ignored by the Sentinel and completely misrepresented by the Good Times, the Indie Bay has a pretty good article on that right now.
I've made a lot of comments on that, and based upon my emails with Mayor Don Lane, and we'll continue to update folks on how that goes with the titular head of the city, actually the head real of the city, as I said, is Martine Bernal, and the department heads who really rule the roost. Thanks, Steve.
Well, I guess I do have a closing comment. It just came out of some of the discussion. This kind of, you know, how these internet things go in endless comments upon comments. But there was some discussion about, you know, building up some pressure from the grassroots. And I am frustrated with Don Lane. You know, what's the point of being an official if you're not going to take a stand on things that are important to you? And yet, it's also true that officials can't easily get stuff done unless there's a kind of a swell of support and pressure. And so I think that, you know, a lot of, there aren't the housed people by far outnumber the houseless, and the houseless are, some of them are not mentally in a great state to be organized and stuff. So all of us housed and houseless, we need to get together, and not everyone. And, you know, I think that the conservative element of the Santa Cruz City Council is much out of proportion to the actual conservatism among people, but we need more engagement and from people who are compassionate and progressive, and we need to build, you know, enough pressure so that it's not possible for the city council to be so violent and disrespectful towards the homeless population and not even get chastised in the press about it.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
And that was Steve Schnarr of People Power, who wrote this letter yesterday, actually on August 12th, and it was commented on and republished by the Good Times. I wrote a letter too, which they failed to print, and I tried to find out why, but they never called me back. But what Steve wrote was, "It is false and offensive to suggest that the entire class of very poor are criminals and undeserving of basic human decency. With 10% unemployment, how can we be so callous as to celebrate police charging and guns drawn to the makeshift homes of those poorest among us? I have personally been threatened by homeless individuals as a volunteer at the bike church and had to chase off an aggressive man in Harvey West Park who was shouting at middle school students." He mentioned that. "I was leading on a ride. I hope we can address such problems, but I don't think the SCPD's talents are helping." And that's there are a number of other letters on this site, and there's a lot of letters on today's story, which is a story in the Santa Cruz Sentinel about the, as I mentioned before, the raids by the police, not having the desired consequence of exterminating the presence of homeless people in Santa Cruz with their campsites. And I guess I should, you know, mention this. I'm going to try to, let's see if I can pull it up. Although people can actually go to the Santa Cruz website and read it, and we've talked about it, and the issues are pretty clear for me. Perhaps some of you out there might want to call in, 427-3772, 427-3772. While I wait for the let's play some more interviews from the street, because you get to hear at least a second voice on this broadcast. A third voice, possibly one of your own, might be helpful too. So don't forget, 427-3772 is the call-in number.
Now we're talking with an unprofessional former radio broadcaster whose name is
Hayden B.
And Hayden B., you were on KSCO, the infamous Zwirling Zionist special station, for some time. How long were you there?
We were there for between 4 to 5 months, I would say.
What kind of a show did you have?
We had a late-night talk radio show, and we covered a lot of different topics. It was... Now Mr. Norris is doing some acrobatics here, but
trying to retain the high ground here.
Yeah. We did a lot of political based discussion and some spiritual talks. We did history and really whatever people wanted to talk about when they called in.
How long was your, I mean, what was your length of your show?
It was a 2-hour spot every Saturday.
And did you, you had a sponsor?
No, we were sort of chosen by Michael for our relatively radical political insight as far as shaking up a generally conservative audience base that they have, especially in the Monterey Bay in general.
What's your most radical five shows?
Well, there, we try to intersperse it, you know. We try to do something tame and then shake people up so that people didn't feel like they were being attacked, but it was sort of a subtle penetration of their ideologies.
As you were doing a sort of a infiltration kind of thing.
Yeah. It was, you know, you gotta switch up the method or else people get savvy to what your motives are real quick.
So, but what were these radical shows that attempted to pierce the veil of ignorance and simplicity surrounding the right-wing mind fog?
Well, we didn't, you know, we weren't just exclusively attacking, you know, a right-wing, per se, view. We were trying to unpack and question all political affiliations and get to the roots, if you will, to use arboretic terms, you know, the root belief, or, you know, maybe the capillary beliefs, if you want to take a more rhizominous approach. Like,
abandoning the terminology, let's get specific. What were these shows about that eventually led to your demise?
Well, we had one show that was all spoken word poetry and freestyle rap based.
Was it fuck, fuck, fucking?
There was some fucking.
In the studio?
In the studio, yes. But it was...
Oh, I mean, but I hope you didn't talk about fucking. That would be illegal.
No, it was generally implied. And then we just discussed, in passing satire and farcical joust, the possibilities of overthrowing certain governmental powers and agencies, including
in the local area
and the greater national area.
So you were suggesting overthrow the government by force and violence, perhaps?
Oh no, just by logical and rational questioning of authority.
Any particular focus on local issues that comes to mind?
Yeah, certainly. The issue of sleep outside and the criminalization of sleep and the basic rights that people have to exist and occupy space.
When did this come up? I know, one show, five shows, ten?
This has sort of come up in several different shows, but specifically one show that you were our guest on, discussing how there's a six-month penalty in jail for unlawful lodging and how people like Ed Fry have been really outspoken in their opposition to this, but...
And gone to... Well, they went to the jail to get an ankle bracelet, but Gary Johnson actually last Friday went to jail and is now there for 4 months.
Yeah, so it's very real. You know, it's stuff that...
2 months, actually.
...is on in our local communities that people don't hear very much about because the people that it's happening to don't generally have corporate media influence, you know, like... Or ties with the police, like the Santa Cruz Sentinel.
Any other local issues that came up that you think were perhaps considered controversial by the, I don't know, the standard KSCO backers?
We talked about the potential abolition of private property, and that ruffled a lot of feathers. We weren't really, like, stating a very concrete stance on it, but we were just probing the notion that private property is something that should be taken for granted in our country and in everyone's sort of mindset. But I think that's all I'm going to say for now. So.
The last thing I would ask you before I leave is, what actually precipitated your departure, in other words, and then how did it come about?
It involved us not showing up for one episode, but I think it was more... the sort of adverse reactions that people were having to the fact that their very reinforced and fortified beliefs were being sort of undermined or questioned. And it's not a very comfortable thing to have your ideology shaken up.
So you don't think it was because you skipped out on a show and ducked your responsibilities?
I think it's a culmination of the two.
But you only did this for one show?
Yes.
Your mother was dying? What was the reason?
Actually...
Too busy fucking, perhaps?
It did involve some family issues, but nothing I really want to go into detail.
Was there anything that you could actually, I mean, did you attempt to explain and get?
Well, their reaction didn't really warrant any sort of explication. They were very clear that they didn't want us back, so.
And they also said something effective. It isn't just this one incident, it's other things, or?
I mean, I don't really want to speak about that, but I think it's...
That was your impression,
yeah,
Brad.
My impression.
We'll stop now. I see I've been trying to, you know, squeeze you beyond the apportioned time. We've been talking with...
Hayden B.
Thank you, Hayden.
Yeah.
When will be your next appearance on a radio show?
We'll see. Let's say within a year and a half.
Expecting you to get a free Radio Santa Cruz show?
Maybe, if I got the time, yeah.
And the money.
And the money. Yeah. It's not free radio.
No, well, it's free if you do work for the station, you know. Thank you.
And it's too bad we couldn't get the specifics from Hayden, although... It was a sort of an impromptu interview, as most of my interviews are. KSCO, Michael Zerling's KSCO, also laid off Richard Quigley, an activist with motorcycle helmet activist, most notorious, but also a well-known advocate of citizens' rights in front of courts and an exposer of police misconduct under some prior deputy, some prior sheriffs. And... He was one of the sheriff's minions came to the studio 7 or 8 years ago after he'd criticized some of the deputies' abusive police behavior, as well as the head of the department, the head of the sheriff's department at that time, Mark Tracy. And they told KSCO that they would no longer cooperate, the sheriff's department said, with him if Quigley were allowed to continue. A really outrageous statement. And in response, instead of defending Quigley, they let him go eventually. And that was just typical of, typical of Michael Zwirling, the station guy. But I kind of, you know, I have a sort of a soft spot in my heart for Michael Zwirling. He, 22 years ago, he was active in at least giving homeless activists an opportunity to explain what they were doing, although I think he mainly wanted to embarrass the progressive majority on the Santa Cruz City Council, perhaps. And he also had, as many people do, some really strong feelings about the rights of poor people outside, which is independent of their party affiliation, Republican or Democrat. And sometimes even the most fundamentalist type people, religiously very reactionary, can be very supportive of homeless civil rights, which is interesting and telling in a way. I'm not quite sure what it tells, but... tells something. So, here's some more. And again, you have a chance to call in, 427-3772. 15 minutes left in the show. I guess I also wanted to add that there are a couple things coming up. Tonight there's an open mic for those who want to go to the Sub Rosa Cafe every Thursday night. You sign up at 7:30, and I guess you can probably try to sign up later, but if you don't get there at 7:30, it begins at 8 o'clock. Sub Rosa Cafe is at 7:03 Pacific. There is an 8 a.m. La Playa Carmel boycott and picket coming up, and photographer and journalist Alex DeRosi has done an interesting spread on that on Santa Cruz Indie Media. This is a boycott of the La Playa Hotel down there at Camino Real and 8th in Carmel, California. In addition to the afternoon events, early morning rallies are being held, and this no rehire, no peace is the slogan. La Playa Carmel has only rehired 2 of the 113 former hotel and restaurant workers. So it's, again, laying off people. And the specifics of this, there's a story again, which I said, which Alex has created. Hotel workers and their union representatives are demanding that the former La Playa employees be hired back, as the hotel still has only rehired 3 of the 113 former workers who lost their jobs when the hotel was purchased, remodeled, and reopened by the multimillionaire Sam Grossman. And there's you can actually see some video of this and some video of the police coming up and telling them to move out of the street and arguing with the union activists, trying to get them to essentially back off and disperse or do a quieter approach or, in essence, quell the militancy of what they're doing. And it's an interesting story, and there's more information about the boycott at La Playa Hotel unfair.org, which I'm looking at right now for any of you early birds who want to troop down to Carmel tomorrow morning. There's a boycott of La Playa Carmel going on. It has been going on since July 6th down in Carmel. We urge everyone not to patronize La Playa Carmel until the owner rehires the former workers, said Noe Hinojosa, if I have that right. 33-year bartender at La Playa Hotel before its change of ownership and closing last November 1st. The CEO of the owning company, Classic Hotels and Resorts, a subsidiary of the Phoenix-based Grossman Company Properties, was quoted in a recent local paper stating that two of the 113 business workers have been rehired. So apparently now two or three. The head of Grossman Company Properties is chair and founding principal Sam Grossman. This is outrageous. Grossman didn't even invite me in for an interview, and there are many others with 15, 20, 30 years of experience with the same story. Grossman hasn't even had the decency to give us a chance, so we are asking for the community's help. Please do not patronize La Playa Carmel, and if you already made reservations, cancel them and visit another Monterey Bay hotel. Of course, this is I think most listeners of Free Radio are not going to be spending hundreds of dollars a day at La Playa Hotel, which I've never been to. I used to walk past there years ago. And series of reports on this, their updates, which you can read about on Santa Cruz Indie Media. Let's hear some more reports from the street before I have to hit the street.
All right, well, it's around 20 to 5. I'm up here next to the trestle on Highway 9 where a number of homeless folks, I guess they're bags, black bags, trash bags. This contains homeless property, you think?
Yes. Well, it's Poganips. It's actually, I guess, controlled by the city. But there's no place, not one place for any homeless people to go. They are constantly being harassed by the Santa Cruz Police Department and the Rangers. They have no sympathy for us whatsoever. And the way the homeless is being treated over that incident with that lady that died by a homeless person is just disgusting. Okay, we are all being punished for that incident and looked down upon. So since that has happened, well, and probably before, we are non-stop being hassled by Santa Cruz Police Department and Santa Cruz Parks and Recreation. I'm thoroughly disgusted with the way the city is being ran. I lived here back when I was 20 years old when they filmed the movie Lost Boys, and it was a beautiful place to live. Nobody hassled anybody. Everybody looked out for each other, and we didn't leave a bunch of garbage and needles, and we're not all of us are obsessed with drug addiction here, okay, in our homelessness. Everybody is a hop, skip, and a jump away from their last paycheck. So, you know what? Pay it forward, remember where you come from, and be grateful for what you have because you never know when you're going to lose it all.
Now, we've been talking with
Gail McElroy.
Gail, you were telling me, I picked you up on the road. You were hitching up the road because you had hoped to pick up four bags of your stuff?
Yes, and it's gone. Every stitch of clothing I have is gone.
And what do you make of that? Do you think that was somebody who stole it? Do you think it was destroyed by the tree?
No. I know the homeless people in this area. They know what is mine. They know what my stuff looks like. And I can 100% guarantee it wasn't anybody here.
Now, how long ago had you left it here?
Last night.
And you came down because your camp was rousted, because you had some business to do downtown?
Yes, we are constantly being hoisted out of our camp spot, either the moment we move into it or the very next day. There is no place for us to go. I mean, the police department is literally burning us out of our campsites, and especially if they have a chip on their shoulder on us, they will burn down your campsite to get you out.
Now, you said that you've also talked about people being beaten, which you say you haven't seen, but you say you have seen campsites, what, at a distance or actually up close set afire?
Up close. Matter of fact, the train was going by while the campsite was on fire.
And what, describe what you saw.
From what I saw is the Santa Cruz Police Department purposely setting this fire to evict a certain person that they did not like.
And how was this done?
Well, needless to say, they've tried to be inconspicuous as much as they possibly can, but...
How many cops were involved?
At least two.
And how far away were you?
Well, it was at night, so, you know, I was about maybe 40 feet away.
And were you in your own campsite, or you just sort of...
No, I just happened to be in the area, and I pay attention to everything around me, so...
And without necessarily naming any names, how many people had previously been using the campsite?
Well, there was lots. This person was very kind-hearted. The campsite was supposed to have been a private, owned area, and from what I understand, still is, and we were still... getting tickets from Santa Cruz Police Department that is out of their jurisdiction, handing out tickets for illegal camping on private property? I don't think so.
And so, did you hear any dialogue with the cops, or did you just see, what did you see from your 40 feet away perch?
The fire being set, and people running, and...
How many people ran?
Well, the people that were at that campsite ran.
Did you notice how many there were?
Well, I can't say exactly because it's a pretty good-sized area.
And what did you see in terms of how the fire got set? Was it some incendiary device? Was it matches?
I really couldn't tell you that. All I know, it went up very quickly.
And you're pretty sure you saw the police do it?
Yes. The police have been coming up here in all black clothing. They are not furnishing any kind of badge. We have our own code if somebody's walking on the tracks that we're not aware of. We have this code that we say, and if you don't say it, then you're obviously a police officer.
Or someone who doesn't know the code.
Right. Well, they're going to say something. If they don't know the code, they're going to say something. These people would not say a word.
Now, you say you've been here, you were back here in the 80s, and, you know, you're still pretty young looking yourself. Have you been living alone? You say you've been camping alone?
Well, I go, I spend time with friends and stuff like that, but sometimes they get a little out there. I mean, sure, some of us have mental health issues and stuff like that, but most of us are pretty darn good at taking care of ourselves, taking our medication and stuff. We just happen to be in a hard predicament. And we're not all out to kill people. But we're clean. We clean up after ourselves. We don't leave trash laying around. And we go a ways to use the restroom, and we clean up after ourselves.
How long have you been out in this time?
Going on about a year and a half now.
And before that, you were indoors?
Yes, I was.
For how long?
I was living in South Lake Tahoe.
And what brought you back to Santa Cruz?
I can't take the snow anymore, and, you know, it's cold up there in the wintertime, and there's no place. You can't camp out in the snow, okay?
Sort of an outdoors person, or just a poor person?
Poor person. I'm on disability, and I'm barely making it. Barely.
Well, you seem pretty articulate and well-spoken.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
yeah, we're all generally a pretty good group of people, just misunderstood.
We're looking at these bags under the trestle, these large garbage bags. What do you think is in these bags?
I don't know. I won't go there. I'm good with that.
But your stuff,
opinion, it looks like people's personal property.
I'm going to go take a look. Yeah, it looks like bedding here. I'm looking over this. Yeah. A lot of it looks, you know, like it is disposable, but some of it looks like personal property. Some newspapers. Looks like blankets. There's a satchel, and some of it is garbage. We're talking about 10, 20, 30, 35 big, large garbage bags.
And that was an account from yesterday, an encounter that I had with a falling microphone. No, that was today. Gail McIlroy, I guess, was the name she gave me. And good luck to her. Got about 3 minutes left in the show. Uncle Dennis will be joining you for the next 3 hours, boozing it up in the studio, as is his wont. Perhaps he won't be causing trouble with the Zami Collective with his drunken behavior. I assume he's going to comport himself in an appropriate manner. But you never can tell with Uncle Dennis. He's as you know, he's a man who likes music, a song. He's a joyous sort of fellow in his own curmudgeonly way. So I'm going to leave you in his clutches after this brief bit from a street critic who you can find playing in front of New Leaf Market Off, and he might even be there tonight.
Playing or practicing?
He's a little of both, I think. He's pretty good. Well, I don't know. He seems to be an accomplished musician, and he's also an outspoken individual, so that's really more to the point here.
So here I am down on Pacific Avenue. It's not late at night. It's a Saturday night. It's around 9 o'clock, a little after 9, talking with...
Ricardo Lopez.
It's Saturday, August 25th, actually. And you said you had an encounter with Deputy Chief Clark?
Deputy Chief Clark, because I'm smarter than he is, quicker-witted. Okay, he's a hick pig from a little hick town, and he acts like it. He threatens to beat up a 60-year-old man because I'm smarter and quicker-witted than he is, and he just got mad because I was just so smart and so quick-witted, and I told him exactly what he would do. And after he makes all of these hollow threats, to first he says he'll take me to jail. I said, no, you won't. I said, because they'll laugh at you for taking a 60-year-old man and all of his kit into jail.
Now, you are here on the corner with your guitar.
Yeah, this was the other morning when he told me to. He comes up without announcing who he is, gives me a whole bunch of shit about something that isn't even illegal.
Well, what does he say? What happened?
My bike was leaning up against an empty building. He came up and said, you can't lean your bike up against stuff. I pointed at the no anything sign, said, look, it's not listed. It's fine. It's open. He says, well, they'll come by and give you a ticket. I said, fine. I said, call. And then he kept insisting. I said, fine, call the pigs. He said, one's here. So as soon as he identified
himself. Was he in plain clothes? Or?
Yeah, plain clothes. As soon as he identified himself, I just moved the bike because I was still trying to have my coffee. Then he says, I said, so give me a ticket with, you know, I talk about with a thick San Francisco accent, which kind of sounds like a gay Negro. And, you know, he no doubt hates gays and hates Negroes. So I said, fine, give me a ticket, Crime Stopper. Well, I may not have said Crime Stopper, but it was implied, meaning, oh, is this what you have to do, hick? And he says, I'll just take you to jail. Then I had to laugh and turn around. I laughed. I said, no, you won't. Everybody's laughing at him by now because I'm screaming
at him. How many people are actually watching?
All kinds of people. It's between the cafes here. Yeah. My brothers told me, put a freaking restraining order on him if he's a problem. But anyway, they said, he comes up and he says, I said, you won't take me to jail, stupid. I said, you stupid pig. They'll laugh. They'll laugh at you because there's no, because for taking a 60-year-old man and all of his kit into a jail.
I got you. Now, how long did this whole thing take, Ricardo?
Oh, quite a while. Then he says to me, I said, where they have prisoners from the prison, state prison, are going in there. He said, then I'll take your stuff. I said, no, you won't, or my family will litigate against you, okay? We'll sue your ass. He says, then I'm going to put my foot upside your head. I said, oh, is that how it is? I'm smarter than you, so you're going to beat me up? He says, yeah, yeah. And then he follows me down the street, yelling, come on, come on, trying to get me to fight. I keep laughing at him, saying, a hick pig in a hick town where the deputy sheriff goes around threatening old bums to beat him up because they're smarter than he is. You know, they ought to get a smarter pig. What kind? This is going to stay a little hick town as long as they have hick ideas.
Let me ask you a few simple questions, Ricardo. This was what day specifically? Yesterday?
Oh, it's a few days ago. I already called my family to see if we can sue. They said you have to have damages first. But they said put a restraining order on him.
On a police officer, hard to do.
No, it's real easy to do. The first one. The second one, I've got witnesses. In fact, I have a witness who says that he'll he'll come down and testify for me.
And what time of day or night was it?
I was early in the morning. I'm trying to have my coffee.
Well, he's been at what coffee shop?
At the usual ones, Starbucks and, you know, the two. He even came snooping around the next day. I got so to him. I mean, is that cost effective? Is that the kind of hick pig that you want to give for the image of Santa Cruz?
Was there any video?
I'm going to get some next time because he's a freaking martial artist who goes around picking fights with old men because he's got a little man complex. He's real short, so he tries to pick fights with people he's sure he can beat. What a hick.
Well, we're going to have to get the other side of the story from the very distinguished Deputy Chief Steve Clark.
Yeah.
Steve Clark.
He's a real hick, dude. You got does Santa Cruz want that? Is that cost effective to have the Deputy Chief down here giving tickets or trying to do shit or making hollow threats? Still, follow me down the street. I'm going to beat you up. Is that what Santa Cruz wants?
Interesting. Thank you. We've been talking with
Ricardo Lopez.
Thank you, Ricardo. Yeah.
And I will be personally contacting Deputy Chief Clark to see if he wants to appear on Free Radio to refute and rebut these rather astonishing charges about threatening to arrest, threatening to seize property, threatening to beat up. I couldn't believe that Deputy Chief Clark would possibly do any such thing. And actually, I'll talk more about the deputy's history. He's the only deputy who I've ever actually accused of physical abuse against me personally. Next show, and that'll be Sunday at 9:30 for those of you who want to check it out. Santa Cruz 11 will be doing a banner downtown tomorrow, standing next to the Women in Black at 5 o'clock downtown at the corner across from the Cinema 9 if you want to check that out. And I'll be back on the